BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Starlet Radio. The show is coming to you from the Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to our listeners in Preston and also in South America. Tonight we have an interview with Kern. He works in the Reckless Engineer pub in Bristol. He's the landlord. And that's just by Temple Gate, by Temple Mead Station. We have part 3 of the Gaza Trip interview with Mohammed El Haddad, and also part 7 of the Princess Diana interview. Rachel Edmondson can't be with us tonight. She says she's stuck in Cardiff. Gutted. But she'll be back next week to sing us a song. Malcolm Gree continues with the history of the Mafia. I'm John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's show. Now it's time for part 3 of our Gaza Trip interview, which is Mohammed El Haddad, who's the director of the UK Arabic Society, and he got together with many other people, part of the Viva Palestina collective, who were going to take many vehicles, about 138 they started off with, and drive them all the way through the EU and across North Africa to the Rafah crossing to get into Palestine to give aid. So this is part 3 of his trip.
Okay. One of the problems that we had also in Tunisia was preventing people from, making and performing Friday prayer in a town called Madnin. We were just about to reach that mosque. We can see the mosque. We can hear the adhan, which is the call for prayer. Mm-hmm. We were just about 200 meters away from the mosque. And the people said, no, you cannot just cross the government, the escorts. Right. You can't go into the mosque because, you know, you might be engaged with people and we want you to be in a safe and secure position.
So what were they so afraid of? Why were they continually trying to block any public engagement?
They cannot guarantee that we're not going to be hurt by those people.
So that's what they're telling you?
Yes.
What do you believe?
No, we don't believe in that. We are much secured with the public rather than the governments. Mm-hmm. That's our belief. And I'll tell you what, when we decided to stay at that time and we stood and we said to them, we're not going to go, we have to pray our prayer time on this land. If you don't allow us to enter to the mosque, we're going to have to pray on the motorway. And that's what we did. We gave them 15 minutes. They did not respond. And then after 15 minutes, we were really surprised by the public of Madnin, that little town, to be, you know, fighting for us against their government, mm-hmm. and provided us with a temporary mosque on the motorway, on the roads, and they were preparing the mosque for us. They brought all the carpets, they brought the microphone for us.
How busy was the motorway at this point?
It's the ring road just opposite the town. Mm-hmm. So it was busy and we had to block it.
Right.
Yeah, that's the fact.
How did the traffic behind you like that?
I'm sorry, we must have disturbed everybody, but this is the fact. The government did not allow us to stay in pray in the mosque. Okay. So we stood for about 1 hour and prayed. And after praying time, we just sent off. We were off to another town.
Okay. How did you manage to pick up any followers in when you're on your journey, any supporters with you? How many of you were there compared to when you left London by this point?
We left London, as I said, just over 250. We arrived there about 500 and something. Mm-hmm. But all of the extra number that we had was from Libya.
Okay.
Only from Libya. We were not allowed to take anyone from any other countries.
So also your reception in Libya was very different. Describe sort of the crossing into Libya and what changed.
That was the emotional point to me, basically. I'm originally Libyan and I'm running the organization from London, from Bristol, the UK Arabic Society. We got, a very good links and contact with most of the charities all over the Arabic countries. And in Libya, we got a very good link with the Gaddafi Foundation. Mm-hmm. And we proposed to them the hosting of this convoy, and they were very pleased. They have their own, you know, CV and a very good history with the people of Gaza since the war started. They helped the people there with so many convoys before, and they sent ships as well, and you know, a fleet of aircrafts to Gaza. And they also brought the people who were, you know, injured from the side of the war to Libya, to Tripoli, and they look after them until this point. And we met those people when we arrived to Tripoli. Okay. They were in our reception as well.
So EU aside, when you arrived in Tripoli, this is the first occasion you managed to get into a capital city.
It was in the border, and it was in the border, which is in the desert, about 150 kilometers from the capital city. And we were shocked. We've seen a big number of people, around 4,000 or 5,000 people waiting for us in the Saturday morning, very early hours in Saturday morning. And in that particular point, I cried. I did not manage to control myself. I cried a lot because of the well reception we have, and comparing to a few hours ago in Tunisia, the, you know, misunderstanding between us and the governments.
What do you feel the public reaction to you would have been if some public engagement had been allowed in Morocco, Algeria and Tunisia?
That will put pressure on Israel and the whole world. And also it may, you know, affect our donation positively. Mm-hmm. They may add some, you know, donation to whatever we have from Britain to, you know, double it by the time we arrive to Gaza.
Yeah.
But we had 1 million, we delivered 1 million, apart from the 7 million we had from Gaddafi Foundation, worth of 8.
Okay. And you left London with that amount. I mean, how much did you manage to gain any en route?
We were not told that we gained anything from the governments, unless the management have taken something and passed over to Gaza.
Right.
But as a convoy, as drivers, we were not told. Apart from the amount that we have seen by our eyes, 138 vehicle, big lorries, full of equipment, medicine, clothes, and, you know, everything you think that those people in Gaza will need were loaded in that 138 vehicle from Gaddafi Foundation. Mm-hmm. The value of that, you know, convoy was over 7 million US dollar.
Do you think they had any political motivations in terms of being so friendly towards you, or how much of that was sort of...
I think it's a big history between Libya and Palestine, long time ago, with Yasser Arafat, with Abu Ammar, between him and Gaddafi himself.
Yeah,
I'm not going to get involved with this because I knew that there is a very good relationship and he's supporting this country long time ago.
Okay, so basically, as long as you were getting aid for the people of Gaza...
This is our aim. That's what we wanted, yes.
Okay. Now, in the midst of such positive reception, I understand two people passed away in Libya.
That's right. There were a reporter and a photographer, a lady called Saad Abu Shaiba. She was the reporter of Qurina newspaper. It's a very well-known newspaper in Libya. They sent this lady and a group of people with her. They had a serious, you know, car accident in the far east of Libya. And, you know, that lady died straight away. She died straight away. And the second day, one of her colleagues, the photographer, died as well. We lost two people in Libya.
Okay. I understand you founded a city. Is this right?
That's right, yes. There were a city built in a small town, in a town called Musrata.
Right.
And it's about 200 kilometers away from Tripoli. Mm-hmm. That city was built and prepared for another name. It was to be called something else. But when we arrived, those people, the hospitality of those people made them change their mind, and they offered us to call this village Gaza al-Azza. Al-Azza, which is proud.
Right.
The village is already built and ready to be used by public straight away.
Yeah.
So they were preparing this village to take another name, but now the way they hospitalized us is to give us the chance to call it the name we wanted.
Okay. And they were inspired by your arrival.
Absolutely, they did, yeah.
Now, all the while, I mean, when you left London, you didn't have as much press attention as you would have liked. What sort of press attention did you manage to get en route through the Arabic countries?
I myself was interviewed about 10 times. I don't know why, possibly because I speak Arabic and English. And I was, you know, in a probably sort of a position where I can speak to people due to the organization I'm running. Mm. And also probably a personal contact with people. But we were in the spot all the way long through the Arabic countries. And that was a good decision we had. Rather than going through the EU, we went through the North Africa. That was a good decision we had.
That was Mohamed El Haddad, and we're going to hear more from him later in the show. But first, I'd like to introduce Kern, who is the landlord of the Reckless Engineer Pub in Templegate, right here in Bristol. Hello, Kern.
Hello, John.
How did you come by the name Kern?
It's actually my middle name.
Okay.
And my father has got the same name as me, so they use my middle name and his first name. Apparently I've got an Irish grandmother somewhere and he's Irish.
Okay, right. You're the landlord of the Reckless Engineer, which is at the bottom of the driveway that leads up to sort of the Temple Mead station. So do you get a lot of sort of passing business from people who are coming and going to the station?
We do get a lot of passing business, and it's good because you get a variety as opposed to a pub in a local area where you get the same people every day.
Yeah. My main point of interest that stood out to me when I sort of found out a bit about the Reckless Engineer is that on the GWR radio station, which apparently is now known as Heart, the Bush and Troy Breakfast Show named the Reckless Engineer as the roughest pub in Bristol. What have you got to say about this?
I think it's very unfair considering Bush and Troy on the same show admitted they'd never been in a pub. And also before that, they'd phoned up and asked to use our pub as a venue. So if it's that rough, why do they want to go both ways on it?
Do you get quite a lot of violence in around sort of the Reckless Engineer? What's the atmosphere like?
We've never had a problem.
Never had a problem?
Never. I've had to phone the police twice so far, and both times it's because football supporters coming into Bristol to go to the game. It's not regulars, nothing to do with the pub as such.
Yeah.
We're the first as well as the pub off the station. Mm. And on a football day, you've got to watch out for the visiting fans. And actually, some of the home fans can be very bad as well.
All right. How long have you been a landlord there?
I've been there about a year and a half now. Mm-hmm. But on and off, I've worked there 10 years. The first pub I worked in was in 1991.
Right.
And that was the Bristol Brew House on Stokes Croft.
Okay.
Which is now called The Croft.
A lot of pubs get the blame for underage drinking and drinking on the streets and obviously alcohol problems. As a landlord, I mean, what do you say to people if you know, you see somebody in your pub sort of getting who's clearly drinking too much? What are your sort of views on drinking?
Coming in the day, if someone's drunk in a pub and the police walk in, I get done for it. If I get caught with underage drinkers on the premises, I get done for it. I can lose my job, my licence, my house, basically. How many pubs do you know sell White Lightning in 3-litre bottles? They don't. They're obviously getting them from somewhere else, mm-hmm. and we're always the ones who get the blame.
Yeah.
And it's totally unfair. Every time they clamp down on pubs. It's off licences and supermarkets that are doing the cheap deals, which is where the problem arises, because they know they're not going to get caught with those people on their premises.
Do you kind of feel a little bit bitter that the Reckless Engineer is kind of getting a bad name, despite the fact that obviously if you're the first pub people come to when they get off the train, it's not hardly your fault, is it?
I don't think we've got a bad name. That was just one radio show, which they've even admitted that they hadn't been in there, so who told them that, I do not know.
There's been a lot of legislation about live music in pubs. A lot of people have been criticising laws that they're trying to introduce, claiming that they make it more difficult for you to be able to get bands on. And the Reckless Engineer, I see adverts for an awful lot of live bands mainly rock bands. How do you feel live music in pubs is going?
There aren't enough pubs that play it. But to get a license to play live music, you've got to meet fire regs and other regulations and soundproofing regulations, and they make it more awkward for you to get the license to do live music. It's unfair because you can play pipe music, if you want to put it like that, as loud as you want. But the minute you've got a band on, you've got to have extra space, you've got to have the fire people come in and check everything, and there's, you've also got to have electrical testing done, and it's a lot more involved, which puts people off. So then you don't get as much places for live music to play.
Have we got... you worked at the Brew House, and Jeff sort of hinted to me beforehand. He said, mention the massage parlour story. It's really funny. So I'm curious now, what's the massage parlour story?
Well, just down the road from the Brew House, there's a massage parlour. And we had... They used to phone us on a Sunday, and we used to take their Sunday dinners down for the girls.
Right.
We had a young lad start for us. He was about 18.
Right, okay.
So they phoned up on a Sunday for their dinners, and we got him to take them down.
Okay.
But we'd had a word with the girls beforehand and said, like, when he gets there, tell him that you don't pay, kind of, you sort him out in the back room.
Right.
So off he went.
Yeah.
He come back about 10 minutes later, out of breath, scared, saying he'd never go back there again. Because the minute they kind of said, well, come out in the back room, we'll sort you out, he was like, well, no, I need cash. No, out the back, lad. And he just ran out of the place. he would never go down there again. We just done it to wind him up.
Yeah. Did he see the funny side in the end?
Eventually, yes.
Eventually.
After we'd calmed down and stopped glowing beetroot.
Yeah. Oh, bless him. The smoking ban has changed the nature of a lot of pubs in Bristol. How do you feel about a smoking ban? Are you smoking yourself?
I am a smoker, yes.
Yeah.
Years ago, in pubs, they used to have, like, a smoking room and a non-smoking room.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. And pubs were always smoking, drinking and swearing.
Yeah.
At the moment, we're not allowed to smoke. When they first brought the ban in, the reason they brought in is so many people would go and start drinking in pubs because there was no smoking. Our trade hasn't picked up through non-smokers coming in. It's dropped because smokers can't be bothered to go and stand outside. So it has knocked our business, but there's not a lot we can do about it.
Yeah.
And all these people who would suddenly start drinking in pubs because there was no smoking, they haven't turned up. And basically, it's... I think it's seven pubs a week. No, seven pubs a day, maybe, are closing down because they've just keep putting tax, VAT, duty price on beer. Then they ban smoking. A lot of people go to the supermarket, sit at home and have a fag. So they just keep hitting pubs all the time. And they're not giving it anything back. When they start closing down all the post offices, it was a thing about the community. You're losing the community feeling. Pubs are closing down, and that is part of a community as well. But the government don't seem to realise that. They seem to tax, and anything they can make money out, they tax.
Yeah. Kern, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you very much, John.
Best of luck for the future.
Cheers. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's now time for Malcolm Grieve to read us another part of the history of the Mafia. We've been indulging in lots of the history of organised crime and all the various crime gangs. I think we're starting to focus more on the fighting of crime and crime-fighting people.
History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, is the world's most famous law enforcement agency. There is no denying part of its renown is down to the Hollywood myth-making machine, but it has also earned its prominence by leading the way in developing crime-fighting techniques and technology, and through some amazing success stories in the fight to uphold the law. One area where the FBI's record of success is balanced against a history also marked by inaction and massive failure is in the fight against American organized crime. The development of a national police force in the USA ran parallel to the early development of the American Mafia, whilst the opposing forces on the spectrum of justice should have been natural enemies. It was not until 1957 that the FBI seriously started to fight the forces of the Cosa Nostra and other US criminal syndicates. What was to evolve into the FBI started out in 1908 as a force of special agents instigated by US Attorney General Charles Joseph Bonaparte. Originally called the Bureau of Investigation, it did not change its name to the FBI until 1935. Although many of its signature crime-busting techniques, such as wiretapping, infiltration, and the pioneering use of cutting-edge forensic science, were all in place by the early 1930s, none of them were actually used by the Bureau against the developing network of mafia crime families. When President Hoover wanted to bring down Capone's Chicago outfit, he had to turn to the US Treasury rather than the FBI. The main reason for this was the other Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI from 1924 to his death in 1972. For decades, J. Edgar Hoover insisted that there was no organized crime network in the United States. In his view, there was no such thing as the Mafia. Despite all the blatant evidence to the contrary, despite protests of his own men who desperately wanted to pursue the big bosses, J. Edgar Hoover claimed there was no Mafia to investigate. No one has definitively been able to explain J. Edgar Hoover's bizarre position with regards to the Mafia. Some believe the Genovese crime family of Mayor Lansky was blackmailing him with pictures of him dressed as a woman, or having sex with his right-hand man, Clyde Tolson. Others put it down to him not wanting his men to be open to corruption through having to deal with the Mafia, or that he was worried they could be publicly seen as ineffective if they went up against them. It could have been that J. Edgar Hoover saw the Mafia as an effective bulwark against communism, or even his gambling addiction and his own association with the Mafia's Prime Minister, Frank Costello. Whatever the reasons behind him effectively killing all investigation into organized crime, the situation was blown apart by the public exposure of the Appalachian Conference in 1957, the Kefauver and McClellan Committees 1950-1951 and 1956-1968, respectively, and Robert F. Kennedy's anti-mafia campaign, 1960-1963. Once J. Edgar Hoover was forced to face up to the reality of the situation, the FBI quickly began to catch up, after more than three decades of sitting on its hands. It began to hurt the Mafia's operations across the country, hitting it hardest on union rackets. With the introduction of the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO, in 1970, and J. Edgar Hoover's death in 1972, the FBI's war against the Mafia moved up several gears. With an explosion of electronic surveillance, federally protected witnesses and stool-pigeon mafiosi cutting deals for lighter sentences, by the late 1980s the FBI had put away a lot of the Cosa Nostra's top men and claimed to have made massive inroads against organized crime's power in the US. Recently, the FBI's fight against organized crime has been blighted by revelations of collusion between FBI agents in Boston and the city's notorious Irish organized crime outfit, the Winter Hill Gang. With corruption and an increasing focus on terrorism, many are worried that the FBI's gangster-fighting days are waning. When the names Robert F. Kennedy and Cosa Nostra come together on the page of a book, it is usually the prelude to a conspiracy theory. Given the links between the Kennedy family and leading mafia figures, such as Carlos Marcello or Sam Giancana, most of these theories, however, are not entirely unreasonable. The problem with conspiracy theories is that they tend to obscure the amazing role that Robert F. Kennedy played in the fight against the American Mafia. Cynicism and an awareness of the corruption that can occur between the worlds of politics and organized crime prevents most of us from thinking of politicians as crime fighters. However, that is exactly what Robert F. Kennedy was. During his life, he was possibly the single most dangerous man that the Mafia had ever come up against. Robert F. Kennedy first made a name for himself as a man who was willing to go toe-to-toe with the Mafia in his role as chief counsel of the Senate Labor Rackets Committee hearings, which began in 1956. The hearings, commonly known as the McClellan Committee, introduced television viewers to the young Kennedy. Via heated confrontations and bouts of insult hurling with Teamster Union boss Jimmy Hoffa, Robert F. Kennedy exposed the links between union leaders and Cosa Nostra members, such as Anthony Corallo. It soon became clear to everyone, especially the Mafia, that Robert F. Kennedy had good sources of information, knew a lot about them, and was going to do everything in his power to destroy their profits and power. It's well known that there was a collective sigh of relief for mafiosi nationwide when Robert F. Kennedy quit the McClellan Committee to help run his brother's presidential election campaign. Their relief was short-lived, however, as the newly elected President John F. Kennedy appointed his brother Bobby as U.S. Attorney General. Within weeks of him taking over the post, it was clear he was going to be the first ever Attorney General to use the job to try and dismantle the organized crime networks that had been part of the U.S. since the 1920s. J. Edgar Hoover was forced, much against his will, to step up the fight against organized crime. Robert F. Kennedy, who had recently published his book, The Enemy Within, made it open knowledge that he was running a Get Hoffa campaign. Unlike other attorney generals who would talk tough about tackling underworld problems and do nothing, Kennedy walked the talk. He knew the identity of all the big bosses and was constantly chasing FBI, Federal Bureau and Department of Justice agents on the progress they were making against them. He never let up. It was a constant crusade for him. Not surprisingly, it did not make him popular with Hoover or the likes of Sam Giancana. Robert F. Kennedy's work did have some fans, though, one of whom was Harry J. Anslinger. The first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, Anslinger was one of the few senior men in U.S. law enforcement to tackle organized crime in America. Despite J. Edgar Hoover's claims that there was no such thing as the Mafia, in his 1964 book, The Protectors, he told how Kennedy traveled the country holding special meetings with his Federal Bureau of Narcotics agents, exhorting them to nail the big drug traffickers and ensuring them they had full support from the prosecutors. He claimed that it was in large measure due to his forceful encouragement that we knocked off some of the biggest public enemies. The irony of Robert F. Kennedy's determination to battle against organized crime has not been lost on historians. The man who banned Frank Sinatra from the White House because of his mafia links was also the son of Joseph P. Kennedy, a man who had made a bootlegging fortune during the Prohibition era. Joseph Kennedy also used his associations with mafia leaders to help them swing JFK's presidential election win. Despite these and other familial links to Cosa Nostra, there is little doubt that before his brother's assassination cut his term as Attorney General short, Robert F. Kennedy was delivering some painful blows to the Mafia. His lasting legacy is that the FBI became feared by the mob. If an assassin's bullet had not taken his own life 5 years later in 1968, he may have become a US president that was willing and capable of actually turning the tide in the constant war against organized crime.
Thank you to Malcolm Grieve, the actor, for reading us another part of The History of the Mafia by David Southwell.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Time to hear another clip from the Panorama interview that we've split into seven parts. We've heard all the way from Charles and Diana getting married in 1981 up till about 1995. The BBC's Martin Bashir back in 1995, interviewed Princess Diana, and she spoke for the first time about many things that she'd never spoken about in public before. I'm sure we all know what they are by now. And it has never been repeated since. It's never been heard since. Today we have part seven, the last part. She concludes with a vision for the British monarchy and whether Charles or William should succeed Queen Elizabeth.
What kind of monarchy do you anticipate?
I would like a monarchy that has more contact with its people. And I don't mean by riding around bicycles and things like that, but just having a more in-depth understanding. And I don't say that as a criticism to the present monarchy. I just say that as what I see and hear and feel on a daily basis in the role I have chosen for myself.
There's a lot of discussion at the moment about how matters between yourself and the Prince of Wales will be resolved. There's even the suggestion of a divorce between you. What are your thoughts about that?
I don't want a divorce. But obviously we need clarity on a situation that has been of enormous discussion over the last 3 years in particular. So all I say to that is that I await my husband's decision of which way we are all going to go.
If he wished a divorce to go through, would you accept that?
I would obviously discuss it with him, but up to date neither of us have discussed this subject, though the rest of the world seems to have.
Would it be your wish to divorce?
No, it's not my wish.
Why? Wouldn't that resolve matters?
Why would it resolve matters?
It would provide the clarity that you talk about. It would resolve matters as far as the public are concerned, perhaps.
Yes, but what about the children? Our boys, that's what matters, isn't it?
Do you think you'll ever be queen?
No, I don't, no.
Why do you think that?
I'd like to be a queen of people's hearts, in people's hearts. But I don't see myself being queen of this country. I don't think many people would want me to be queen. Actually, when I say many people, I mean the establishment that I'm married into, because they've decided that I'm a non-starter.
Why do you think they've decided that?
Because I do things differently. Because I don't go by a rule book. Because I lead from the heart, not the head. And albeit that's got me into trouble in my work, I understand that. But someone's got to go out there and love people and show it.
And do you think that because of the way you behave, that's precluded you effectively from becoming queen?
Yes, not precluded me, I wouldn't say that. I just don't think I have as many supporters in that environment than I did.
You mean within the royal household?
Mm-hmm. They see me as a threat of some kind. And I'm here to do good. I'm not a destructive person.
Why do they see you as a threat?
I think every strong woman in history has had to walk down a similar path, and I think it's the strength that causes the confusion and the fear. Why is she strong? Where does she get it from? Where is she taking it? Where is she going to use it? Why do the public still support her? When I say public, you go in and do an engagement and there's a great many people there.
Do you think the Prince of Wales will ever be king?
I don't think any of us know the answer to that. And obviously it's a question that's in everybody's head. But who knows? Who knows what fate will produce? Who knows what circumstances will provoke?
But you would know him better than most people. Do you think he would wish to be king?
There was always conflict on that subject with him when we discussed it. And I understood that conflict, because it's a very demanding role, being Prince of Wales, but it's equally a more demanding role, being king. And being Prince of Wales produces more freedom now, and being king would be a little bit more suffocating. And because I know the character, I would think that the top job, as I call it, would bring enormous limitations to him. And I don't know whether he could adapt to that.
Do you think it would make more sense, in the light of the marital difficulties that you and the Prince of Wales have had, if the position of monarch pass directly to your son, Prince William?
Well, then you have to see that William's very young at the moment, so do you want a burden like that to be put on his shoulders at such an age? So I can't answer that question.
Would it be your wish that when Prince William comes of age that he were to succeed the Queen rather than the current Prince of Wales?
My wish is that my husband finds peace of mind, and from that follows other things, yes.
Why have you decided to give this interview now? Why have you decided to speak at this time?
Because for the last, we will have been separated 3 years this December, and the perception that has been given of me for the last 3 years has been very confusing, turbulent, and in some areas I'm sure many, many people doubt me. And I want to reassure all those people who have loved me and supported me throughout the last 15 years, so I'd never let them down. That is a priority to me, along with my children.
And so you feel that by speaking out in this way, you'll be able to reassure the people?
Mm-hmm. The people that matter to me, the man on the street. Yeah, because that's what matters more than anything else.
Some people might interpret this as you simply taking the opportunity to get your own back on your husband.
I don't sit here with resentment. I sit here with sadness because a marriage hasn't worked. I sit here with hope because there's a future ahead. A future for my husband, a future for myself, and a future for the monarchy.
Your Royal Highness, thank you.
That was part 7 of Princess Diana, Queen of Hearts, where the Panorama BBC interviewer was Martin Bashir. Diana was a local lass for a while, spending a lot of time just north of Bristol at Prince Charles's pad Highgrove, just past Weston Burt on the A433 near Tetbury.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Motorhead have all the aces, so proclaims his T-shirt. Here is Jess Box to tell us what's going on.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is a What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 17th of April, and at the Croft in Bristol, Them Is Me will be performing with support from Riot Noise and also Roxy's Wardrobe. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6.50 in advance. Moving on to Saturday, 18th of April, and at the Cheese and Grain in Frome, Focus will be performing with support from AFGM. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £14 in advance and £16 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and I feature Rainbow. The album Rising was released in 1976 and featured the lineup of Richie Blackmore, Ronnie James Dio, Cozy Powell, Jimmy Bain and Tony Carey. This is a track from that album and it's titled Run With The Wolf.
Change begins by the end.
That was Rainbow with Run With The Wolf from the album Rising. Keeping with Saturday 18th of April and at the Fiddlers in Bristol, Propagandai will be performing with support from Random Hand. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £12 in advance. Also on Saturday 18th of April and at Space 72, which is next door to the Stag and Hounds in Old Market, the Australian alternative rock group The Monacons will be performing. They'll be doing their first UK tour, and the Bristol date is where it all starts. Also on the night, expect performances from Vulnerable Things and also the Band of the Eye. Doors open at 9pm, and entry on the door is £5 and £4 for NUS. Finally, on Sunday 19th of April, and at the O2 Academy in Bristol, the Wailers will be playing the album Exodus in its entirety. Doors open at 7pm, and tickets are £17.50 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, if that's the Focus I'm thinking of, the original Focus, is that?
Yeah, is that it right? Is, yeah. The ones that did Sylvia and
Hocus Pocus.
Yep, that's it.
Indeed. Well, they've got to be worth seeing if you can get yourself all the way down to Frome, wherever that be. Jan Ackerman used to be voted sort of World Guitarist of the Year every year, pretty much, back in the 70s. So I can imagine that would be well worth it. So that's, as a reminder, at the Cheese and Grain in Frome on Saturday the 18th of April.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
It's time to continue with what we started earlier on. We heard from Mohammed El Haddad, part three of the interview, where he describes his journey all the way from London, Bristol to London, and then all the way to the Rafah crossing to cross over into Gaza, into Palestine, to give aid. So let's hear more about that. Okay, we should probably move on and get close to Gaza now. What was Egypt like?
That's the critical area, to be honest. When we crossed to Egypt, we had to stay in a small village called Al-Arish just before Rafah,
mm-hmm.
Where we were in the car park. Everybody were in the car park. The Libyan vehicles, the Libyan lorries, have crossed about 15 lorries across the border to Rafah. And we were just waiting. They said we cannot allow all the convoy to go one time. It got to go through about 15, 20 vehicles a day because of the investigation and, you know, the way they handled the situation.
Okay.
But we did not accept that. People said, no, we just can't, you know, stay for 20 days to allow the whole convoy to go. We have to make our decision. So when they were, the Egyptian government were trying to get the second slot into the border, the whole convoy just moved, not only 15 vehicles. The whole convoy was just moved to go through that gate into Rafah.
Okay.
And then the police stopped and they said, no, we can't do this. And, you know, that was the first, you know, time where people engaged with each other, the people and our people, the convoy and the government, the escorts. And I remember one of the high management people were, injured from the escort side.
So there were conflicts?
Yes. So after probably half an hour, the light goes off, and it was a very dark night. For a few moments, probably five or 4 minutes, we had stone thrown to us, to our vehicles. And, you know, the escort, the police were just watching and, you know, looking at the situation. They did nothing. We were in the middle of the car park. We can't see nothing. Mm. We were not prepared, and we just hardly managed to save ourselves.
Did you know who was attacking you in the dark?
The escort, the police, saying that those people are anti-Hamas, and you are going to support Hamas. That's why they, you know, they felt uncomfortable with your decision. They want to raise their voices to you. But in fact, it wasn't the public, because the public were feeding us. We had 1 day and a half in that particular car park, and that was in the middle of the town.
And this is the Egyptian police we're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah.
The public of that village are Bedouists, and they will never do something like this. I knew those people.
Mm-hmm.
They were feeding us. The women with us, they went to their toilets and their home, and they slept over with them in their houses. So they will never do something like this. Even they disagreed with us in some particular points like Hamas or whatever, the way we look, the way we behave, but they will never hurt any one of us.
So they tried to, they lied to you by saying it's them, and then they pre-organized, they sort of turned the lights off on you, and then they organized an attack on you.
Yeah, two times.
Two times.
Yeah.
Did they try to, what else did they do? Did they kill anyone? What did they?
No, we had five people injured, and they have been to the hospital, and they came back from the hospital to the convoy the same night.
Are these injuries gained by having stones thrown?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And then the second day, after George Galloway and Sister Yvonne announced the effect of that, and they were trying to get the convoy across to Rafah straight away, they were not safe. We are not safe. The British citizens are insecure in this country. We have to cross to Rafah. The second day in the morning, everything was sorted, and we crossed the border.
Wow, that was pretty fast. Pretty quick change then.
Yeah. That made things change. Unfortunately, we had to unload any unmedical aids we had with us.
Right, what did that mean? What sort of effect did that have on what you were able to give?
We were able only to deliver the medicine aids we have.
Okay.
The clothes and the food and everything were left in that car park, and people came and took it in front of us. We can't even argue them.
Just members of the public just wandered up.
Yeah, we don't know who's those people.
That must have been incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, and some of the drivers were very brave. They made the inspectors take and accept some sort of tips and money to allow reloading the clothes into the vehicles.
Oh, so you did manage to work out a way around?
Yes, few people did, not all of us.
Okay, so...
I wasn't, because I'm probably... I speak in Arabic, so they don't accept that from me. But they'll accept it from an English guy.
Okay. So finally, you arrive in Gaza. What confronts you in Gaza? What is
there? One of the things that I've never seen, that when I first arrived there, I went straight away. I was the last vehicle to enter Gaza. Mm-hmm. I had about 4 hours argument with the Egyptian government to allow the boat and the fire engine to enter, and I failed. So the whole convoy entered about 5-6 o'clock in the afternoon, mm-hmm. And then I entered about 11 o'clock in the evening. I failed to get the boat and the fire engine enter.
So what happens then? Will they just...
When I entered, the first. Think I've noticed is that the different circumstances between the two governments.
Yeah.
You know, this is the Egyptian border and this is the Palestinian border. Mm. You know, the way those people are seated, CB radios, telephone, mobiles, lights everywhere, gardens, flowers, everything. You can see it on the road. They are well organized. PC, laptops, computers, internet.
Yeah.
And you cross to that gate, mm-hmm. into the Palestinian, you see the boredness of those people and the government. You can't even see 5 meters in front of you from the darkness. There is no light at all.
No street lighting.
No, I'm afraid not. Even their offices is too old. They haven't even been maintained or republished or whatever for a long time. People have got no way to sit. They have nowhere to sit, even in their offices.
So when you got there in the middle of the night, did you get any public reaction? Was there anyone there to greet you?
Not for myself, I'm afraid, no. I was only hosted by one person who was waiting for me from a small village across the border.
Okay.
And that was arranged by a friend of mine from Egypt.
Okay.
To get me to his place.
But the other vehicles all came...
They have already gone to Gaza with the elected government, Hamas. And I stood with that guy in his tent. I thought, because we arrived about midnight, it was very dark. Everything was dark. We slept in a tent. In the very early hours in the morning, I woke up. I wanted to pray my first salah, which is Fajr, in the morning. So I woke up and I went to pray, and I found people sleeping outside of that tent. And unfortunately, they were even women. And because the place I slept in, it was belonged to a woman and her family. And they hospitalized me and they gave me their tent.
Yeah.
And they slept over on the desert. And that affected me hardly. And I decided not to stay even for 1 hour. I have to leave ASAP. The only thing that kept me there is the press conference, and I gave my vehicle there a few hours, and then I left straight away. Our people were hospitalized by, you know, the elected government, and they stood in a hotel, and they were, you know, given good food. But the people in Palestine, in Gaza themselves, they need this accommodation, and they need this food.
Mm.
So I just said, this is unfair. We should leave this for the needy people, not for us. And I left, and I just stood there about 12 hours. So I was the first person to leave.
To leave Gaza.
Gaza to Egypt. And I left on my own. And anyway, I was all the way along on my own. My vehicle has nobody on it apart from me. Unless when I arrived to Libya, I spoke with my family, and my father and three uncles decided to go with me. And, you know, thanks God that we managed to get them in. And I left them there in Gaza. They wanted to stay in Gaza. I left them there. They stayed. They stood behind me 4 days.
How dangerous is it in Gaza at the moment?
Those people are heroes. They leave where they can see their children taken away from them in a minute, in any particular minutes. And they accepted the situation for the right, for the justice of that country.
How do you mean to have their children taken away from them?
Because of the war. They can be killed at any particular minute.
Hmm.
They are expecting the bomb to become any minute. They are expecting the house to be, you know, bombed any minute. They knew what's going on. The danger they are in, it is, you know, it's clear to them. They knew what's going on there.
But they still venture out during the day and carry on...
The normal life. Yeah. I remember one family using, a fire. They made the fire from the wood. They don't have a gas. So I stopped and I said, let me ask those people. I said to them, when was the last time you had the gas in your home? They said, you know, we had it 5 months ago, and we are waiting for our turn about a month or 2 months. So they were talking about 6 months to get their turn to get the, you know, the gas.
So what do you think is the future for Gaza? You've been and you've delivered the aid and you only stayed a short while. But what do you think is going to happen now?
The future for Gaza, it's between Allah's hands. I think those people will never let the Israeli people do whatever they want in Gaza. They will try to catch up their land, and they will try to keep on it as long as they can. But probably I'm going to mention our future for, the convoy's future is going to have another convoy in the summertime.
Okay.
From the EU, from probably Venezia to Palestine, a fleet of, you know, boats, because the only boat we had did not cross the border to Gaza. It was sent back to Egypt and from Egypt to Venice. So now it is in Venice. We have to get a fleet of boats to cross into Gaza by the summertime.
Okay.
So we are still raising some funds towards that.
If people do want to sort of donate, what can they do? How can they get in?
In terms of fundraising?
Yeah.
Yeah, they can contact the UK Arabic Society at ukarabicsociety.org.uk.
Okay.
Or Viva Palestina website, you can donate online.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would like to hear more about the news of this convoy, the better and the best channel that covered us all the way along is Breast TV.
And courtesy of Yvonne, who travelled with you.
Yes.
The only TV station that was with you all the way.
Yes, that's right.
You can visit www.presstv.ir, I understand, is the website. Press TV is an Iranian TV station. Well, thank you very much for coming, Mohammed El Haddad. I'm very glad that you made it and you came back alive. I bet your wife and children were absolutely delighted. And I wish you all the best of luck with any future convoys, you know, especially the one in the summer.
Thank you so much for that, and I would like to thank the people who supported me and support them, the convoy, particularly Mr. Marat from London, who donated his vehicle and £3,000 to deliver the aid from Bristol to Gaza, and also the people from Bristol Stop the War, Palestine Coloration, and all the supporters of them from this town. Thank you so much, and thank you to you as well. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you once again to Mohammed El Haddad, who spared an evening and an awful lot of time. It was a very long interview because he had an awful lot to say. It was absolutely fascinating. As a reminder, he did that through the Viva Palestina organisation. If you Google that, I'm sure you'll find more information and how you can sort of donate or get involved if you so wish. Well, that's the end of this week's Starlit Radio show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre, right by Queen Square. Just a reminder, if you've just sort of caught us near the end of the episode, we're on 9pm on Saturdays and 7pm on Sundays on BCFM 93.2 FM. You can visit bcfm.org.uk. Our features were brought to us by Dialect Radio reporter Tony Gosling. Malcolm read another instalment of The History of the Mafia. Thank you very much to Kern, the landlord of the Reckless Engineer pub, just by Temple Mead Station, for coming in and having a chat to us about the ins and outs of being a landlord. We hope Rachel Evanson can make it in next week. We look forward to hearing some more tunes by her. The What's On was presented by Jeff Sparks, and Villas Church Curran was the studio engineer. This week's show was produced by Jeff Sparks. You can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Also, if anyone wants to join the team at Dialects, you can send us an email on Bristol Radio Co-op, which is all one word, as in sort of Bristol Radio Coop, at hotmail.co.uk. And that's just to do anything, really. If you're curious and want to come along and watch, you are more than welcome. We won't bite you, and we're all very friendly. It's goodbye from all here at Dialect Radio, and it's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. Until next week, take care of yourselves. Goodbye.